This is the third day of this December 2009 four-day session, and we'll resume reading from our book up to this point. It's called The Original Face, and it's an anthology of Rinzai Zen. And we'll finish up the words of Toray. Is it 19th century Japanese master Toray. We're in what he calls the five discriminations. The title of the chapter is The Essential Secrets for Entering the Way, Words of Master Toray. And this is the fourth of the five discriminations. The meaning of progressive practice. This means that as you urge on your meditation on the fundamental, as just described, you should progress moment after moment, practicing in everything, summoning forth the state of correct mindfulness in meditation. When you walk, you practice while walking. When you rest, you practice while resting. When speaking with people, you practice while speaking, and when silent and quiet, urge on your correct mindfulness all the more. Practice, specifically, would depend on what your practice is while sitting. That is, whether it's breath practice or koan practice or something else. If it's breath practice while you're sitting, then when you walk, you just walk. When you rest, you just rest. When speaking with people, you just speak and listen. If it's a koan, then in all those things, you just try to remain aware of the koan, and when you notice you're not, you just go back to it. It's all training, whether it's breath or koan, it's all training in non-separation, oneness. This is the secret to a life of happiness and responsiveness to others. Most people, to put it mildly, most people, virtually everyone in the world, while walking, they don't just walk, but while walking, their mind is somewhere else. While resting, the mind is somewhere else. When speaking with people, it's somewhere else. Most people, most human beings, are split. They go through their lives divided, doing one thing with their mind somewhere else. The mission, if you will, the mission of Zen is to heal this division, to become whole, to become one. Strictly speaking, we don't have to become one with our lives. We are our lives. It's false to even think of them as two. But if we're lost in thought and we're doing things, and in that sense, our life is experienced as divided. Rinzai himself, Lin Chi, to use his correct Chinese name, was once asked, what is the way? What is the highest truth? And he answered, when hungry I eat, when tired I sleep. Fools may laugh at me, but the wise understand. There's no magic formula. There's no complex instructions. It's very, very simple. It's uncomplicated. Just notice when thoughts are intruding and let go of them. He goes on, Tore, when seeing things, doubt the seer. When hearing things, doubt the hearer. When things are busy and it's easy to get distracted, doubt that which is distracted. When you question what it is that gets distracted, then even when distracted, you do not lose the right mindfulness of your meditation effort. Now he's using doubt in the Zen sense of it, was meaning to turn the mind back and question or wonder. So when seeing, who is it that sees, or what is it that sees? What is it that hears? Who is it that hears? And so forth. This is just a way of not getting caught up in the world of phenomena, of developing detachment from the world of phenomena. So even when you're distracted, doubt that which is distracted. Everything, if your practice is who am I or what am I, everything can be plowed into a question. When you have pain, what is it that is hurting? When you're irritated, who is irritated? When you're drowsy, what is drowsy? And this enables us to get beyond the phenomena, the perception, whatever it is. And when your practice is mu, it's just going to the mu and continuing to question the mu. When sick, you should use your misery as a seed of meditation effort. Anyway, even when things are busy, this too should be a way of progressing in meditation. If things are quiet all the time, there won't be energy in your meditation. Without energy in meditation, there is no empowerment. Well, he's pointing to a danger with these isolated, silent retreats, sesshin. And that is the danger of when it is so quiet and we're so free of any kind of turmoil, then we can, without knowing it, sink into a dullness, a deadness in our practice. But all of us have so many weeks of the year, at least 45, you know, even those of us who go to the most sesshins in a year, we still have like 45 weeks of the year to do the meditation in commotion and busyness. So I think I've always felt that it's wonderful to have this one time when we can just unplug from all of that and dive deep be aware of the risk of just settling into this, what the old masters would call dead sitting and silent illumination. This is one of the reasons why I won't stop having the stick as part of sesshin. It's a way of keeping the people's sitting lively. in many Zen centers where the use of the stick has been abandoned, I suspect because of concerns about litigation. But I think it just is too valuable in the way I just mentioned as far as keeping us from getting into this stupor that is one of the classic pitfalls of meditation. Just becomes a kind of self-hypnosis. And now he uses one of the metaphors that his teacher Hakuin often drew from, and that is the military. This was a time in the Middle Ages and later in Japan where there was a lot of civil unrest. There were different clans waging war on one another. It was it's something that few or any of us can even imagine how this was. He says, when quelling disturbance in the country, when everything is at stake and in the midst of the danger of battle, you fight back and forth without fear. That is when you win victory. The Dharma battle of meditation work is also like this. When distracted by various things and disturbed by various thoughts, that is a good time to decide victory or defeat. In this frame of mind, without laziness, you should progress. When things are quiet, this is really a matter of practicing military arts inside the castle. So understanding, you should cultivate practice with utmost sincerity. This would correspond, of course, to Sesshin. When things are busy, this is the time to decide victory or defeat on the field of battle. So understanding, you should concentrate your effort on directing meditation. Even if you don't attain power in doing this, in both cases, you will be people prepared for the straight and true road of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I think this phrase, even if you don't attain power, I think he may mean by that, even if you don't break through, even if you don't awaken to your true nature, at least your practice is strong and effective. For example, someone in the prime of life is able to walk miles a day, whereas someone who is weak can walk only a short way. In going to a distant country, the strong one may easily get there in a few days, while the weak one may take a few weeks. Nevertheless, once they have arrived, they are in the same country, among the same people. Whether one has sharp or dull faculties or disposition is like this too. It is the same as being sickly and having a hard time getting there, or being strong and going with ease, depending on whether people are sharp or dull, whether their faculties are strong or weak, there will be differences in how quickly or slowly they become enlightened and find the way. But when it comes to the attaining of the way through practice, there is no difference. Should we not take this opportunity? Well, he's pointing out that, yeah, that there are those who calls having sharp or dull faculties or disposition really means one's ability and willingness to refrain from getting involved in thoughts. That's really what it comes down to. There's no... Certainly is not a matter of intelligence. Every single one of us is equally endowed, equally with this bright, enlightened nature. It's just a matter of that some people can more quickly learn to refrain from dwelling in thoughts, and other people it takes longer. It's sort of a difference in learning curve, really, is what it comes down to, but not innate capacity, innate ability. And that learning curve is itself the effect of previous causes, previous lives, work, if you will. But in any case, the way we have, even in this one life, the way we have come to use our minds and our attention up to now, this will determine to a degree how effectively we can hold the mind on the practice and keep returning the mind to the practice rather than going off on side tracks. It's a bit like practice is a bit like driving on an expressway, where your only job is just to stay on the expressway, keep going straight ahead, and not taking the exits, but we all have to learn to not take the exits. We see one there, it looks inviting, and off we go. And before we know it, we're way out in the weeds. Eventually, when we've done that enough times, speaking now in the billions, not just millions, when we've done that billions of times, then we finally start, when it leads us into swamps and thickets, then we finally learn to stay on the expressway. It's not that taking those exits have no value at all. We can go off on tangents in our mind. We can have interesting little exercises and even insights, psychological insights, philosophical insights. But they won't bring us to this realm of no mind that transcends all realms. They won't bring us to awakening. In fact, they can impede our movement toward awakening to our true nature. I hear sometimes about someone confessing that during Sesshin they were working on a skit for our annual Sangha entertainment. There's no doubt that can be very productive, coming up with all kinds of interesting things. But meanwhile, dot, dot, dot. And he goes on, there is another meaning within this progressive practice. When effort is pure and ripe, without thinking of it or considering it, you will find empowerment. Even though you get power, you shouldn't be lazy about cultivating practice. Here, I think he is, when he says get power, that's another way of saying have an opening, have an awakening. Even though you get power, you shouldn't be lazy about cultivating practice. That means ongoing practice after awakening. If you concentrate energy, empowerment comes of itself. So there are great and small empowerments. This must be the translator's choice to come use this word empowerment. I've never heard that as a synonym for awakening. Lesser enlightenment, after all, turns out to be a hindrance to great enlightenment. If you give up lesser enlightenments and don't cling to them, great enlightenment will surely be realized. If you grasp little enlightenment and don't relinquish it, great enlightenment will surely be ignored. This is like someone so greedy for a little profit that he doesn't get a big profit. If he doesn't cling greedily to a little profit, great profit will eventually be realized. If he accumulates, or we could say hoards, small profits, if he accumulates small profits, that's what we want to do, eventually will mount to great profit. Torre's teacher was as strong as anyone has ever been about this need to just let go of whatever awakenings or short of awakening, any insights we have, to just let them go and move on. Otherwise, we can really get stalled. This is a challenge to people on any stage of the path. This is when you first have just a few seconds of clarity and feeling of sense of expansiveness or oneness with the practice. It's so difficult not to get hung up on that and start thinking about it and congratulating oneself. Fantasizing about what that means and what it will lead to. This is why this is so difficult to break through, is that even when we have these really rewarding experiences in our practice, the uplifting, the inspiring experiences, we tend to get stuck in them and cling to them in our mind. This is a practice. True spiritual practice demands ongoing renunciation. Just letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go of everything that we encounter in our practice. Not to let go is to be dwelling in the past, in or the future. When I was new to the center, when I first came here, there was a woman here, an older woman, she's probably younger than I am now, who had some kind of experience that she was convinced was enlightenment. She wrote about it, and she just worked it and chewed on it and powdered herself with it and made such a big deal. She was a flop. Whether it was or not, it doesn't matter. Let's say it was some kind of a opening experience. She completely ruined it by getting stuck there. She didn't come to sesshin. She hardly came to sittings. She just felt enamored of her experience. It was very, I know to Roshi Kaplan, it was very sad. That's an extreme example. What more commonly happens is that someone gets carried away for a while, and then life has a way of leveling us, and then we get more serious again about the practice. He goes on, if you cling to a lesser benefit and do not progress, spending your whole life within the limits of only a small realization, you can't reach the realm of great freedom and great liberation. Unless you arrive at great enlightenment and find the path of great freedom, fact and principle do not harmonize, so you enter into outside paths with false views. This is dreadful. Once you have some small awakening, if you use this as a seed to progress further and further, the great reward of all the Buddhas will be revealed. You pass naturally through the barrier locks of the ancestral teachers. Fact and principle truly accord, with action and understanding not different, you reach the sphere of great liberation and great independence. This is called the essential secret of progressive practice. This reference he makes to using a small awakening as a seed to progress further and further, this is really very much the essential point. Because if it has been a genuine opening, if you have seen into your true nature, you will have seen the limitlessness of practice. You will have seen that there is no beginning to enlightenment and end to practice, and there is no beginning to practice and end to enlightenment. If you don't grasp that, then you haven't had a genuine experience. And if you have grasped it, then after an initial period where you get kind of crazy, then you'll want to go further, deeper. Because you've glimpsed the possibility. And then also that experience of no self means that your practice from then on becomes more effective, because the self, the I, the me, and the my, isn't getting in the way, at least not to the same degree. This is the real value of a Kensho, first awakening, is seeing the illusory nature of this self, and then by virtue of that, the self doesn't. You don't get snarled up in the ego as easily after that. Then that's when practice becomes more smooth and productive. He goes on, exhausting the inner principles of all things, perfecting all virtues of the way as a benefactor of all sentient beings everywhere, explaining the truth, teaching and influencing according to potential and situation, yet without anything lacking, one arrives together with others at the shore of four qualities. These are the four qualities of great nirvana. These are the ones that we chant in the Kanongyo, eternal, selfless, joyous, pure. So the kind of the highest rewards or arrival of serious practice. With this great practice and great vow, make self-help and helping others your task in every life, in every world, never turning back for all time. Here Tore is reminding us of, he's taking the long view and reminding us of what really matters. It's not just grabbing something from oneself and having it, but using whatever insights we have, using it for the sake of others, as well as ourselves. It doesn't leave oneself out. Using it for the sake of others doesn't exclude one's own sake. Let's go back over those things. This is, again, what we want to aspire to do after awakening, or even before. It doesn't matter. Exhausting the inner principles of all things. Okay, going to the very bottom of this mind, this mind that has no bottom. Perfecting all virtues of the way as a benefactor of all sentient beings everywhere. Well, this would include living in harmony with the precepts, which is just, that just describe our true nature, these precepts, explaining the truth, okay, being available to help others, instruct and guide others, teaching and influencing according to potential and situation. This means to apply skillful means to adapt the teaching to the individual or the group, to accommodate it to people. There is no one truth as it is expressed and demonstrated. It takes different forms with different people at different times. That's really that's really the essence of teaching is the skillful means. And you can see teaching here as in a very broad sense, as any time you're asked, you go to Christmas to your family and someone asks, what is this Zen anyway? Right there, you've got about 1,000 different ways you can respond, one of which is just almost silence. If it's a very casual, insincere question, then you don't want to waste time trying to answer it. Even if it's sincere, I would advise that you keep it very short. And then wait to see if there is a follow-up. If the person is sincere, then they will ask more. But the last thing we want to do, of course, is to start gabbing and gabbing about, what this great Dharma. The first thing always when responding to a question like that is to determine the mind state of the person. What is that question coming out of? And it's not like you can have a list of boxes to check in your mind. It's not anything nearly that organized. It's just getting an intuitive sense of the person and what response would be best for that particular person at that particular time, which could be different the following Christmas. So that's teaching and influencing according to potential and situation. And then again, with this great practice and great vow, make self-help and helping others your task in every life, in every world. In the meantime, though you may make mistakes and regress, if your legs are weak and the road slippery, you fall and you'll die there if you don't get up. Yet, if you keep getting up when you fall and keep going on, eventually you'll get there. When it says in the sutras that when we commit a fault, we should repent right away before the Buddhas and again proceed on the path, this is what it means. And then the fifth of his five discriminations, the meaning of returning to the basis. As the work previously described progresses and your practice becomes wholly mature, eventually you return to the nature of the same one substance of all the Buddhas. This is called fulfilling Buddhahood. This is what is referred to in the Zen schools as seeing true nature and fulfilling Buddhahood. When the first thought goes wrong, and instead of turning inward to the basic mind, it ranges outward to myriad objects, we go on floating and sinking in the six paths, generation after generation, revolving in these routines for a thousand lives over myriad eons, like the wheel of a cart. We have experienced the same pains and troubles countless times. If the bones of every life were piled up, they would be higher than a mountain. And if their pus and blood were stored, they would be more than the waters of the ocean. So the realized one has explained. There are references by the Buddha in more than one sutra to this fact of how many countless lifetimes we have lived in the past and how much suffering we have wrought in the course of these countless lifetimes. Again, no one has to believe this to practice Zen and come to awakening, but when you reflect on it, it can, as and consider it as a possibility, then it can make you take it all more seriously, this matter of practice and the opportunity before us. Now, having a human body so difficult to get, and having encountered the teaching of enlightenment, which is especially hard to encounter, and therein to have heard the inconceivable true teaching of the great vehicle is the greatest fortune anyone can have. If you mistakenly ignore this, it would be the greatest wrong you can do. It is said that once you lose the human form, it is as hard to get it again as to drop a thread from the highest heaven to thread a needle at the bottom of the ocean with it. You know, when these teachers refer to acquiring a human body or finding ourselves born in human form, it's always implies body-mind. The two are inseparable, that to be born in a human body means to be endowed with this capacity for self-awareness, the ability to see one's mortality, to be aware of oneself, and to do something about the implications of that. Also, the routines of transmigrations in the six realms are not only a matter of other lives. Even in one day, there is floating and sinking. Those whose minds are upright and actions not evil are humans. When they get angry, they are anti-gods. Those are the fighting demons, fourth highest realm. If they cling to things they like, they are hungry ghosts. When their minds are stifled by worry and longing, they are animals. When their longings are deep and their greedy attachments are strong and the flames of their rage never die down as they inflict pain on people and harm beings, they are hell dwellers. This is called losing the human form and creating the seeds of the three mires. Most people do evolve and devolve in the course of a single day, going through these different states of mind, finding oneself reacting out of blind passion in this way or that way, clinging, craving, raging. Then again, sometimes the mind is still. There is no anxiety, and the heart is clear throughout. Then it is said that even though the body is in the human realm, the mind soars. Thus, in one day, an ordinary person transmigrates countless times, during which he rarely keeps the human mind, much less roams in heaven. To begin with, they wander mostly in the three mires of animal anxiety, ghostly greed, and ungodly wrath. Often they enter hellish ways, causing suffering to people and injuring beings. Truly, we should see how much we wander in what paths over the course of a day. Even disciples and self-enlightened ones should be honored. What he translates as disciples is the Sanskrit word is shravakas. This means one who has heard the teaching of the Buddha and embraced it. Even disciples and self-enlightened ones should be honored. How much more the way of bodhisattvas? Even the way of bodhisattvas is a rare fortune. How much more so the teaching of the one vehicle of Buddhahood. Seeing reality and realizing the path is the crowning meditation of the Buddhas. Those who set their minds on this are direct children of Buddha. In every moment of consciousness, they carry out unexcelled practice of virtue. With every step, they reach the ineffable action of transcendent wisdom. As far as wisdom is concerned, even the merit of reading or reciting words of wisdom is great. How much the more so to carry them out? Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.